Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
California loses round two in the race to the top. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. California won't be getting $700 million in federal money for efforts to reform education. We'll talk with the Superintendent of Public Instruction, the LAUSD, and the California Federation of Teachers about why the state came up short for a second time. Also tonight, a judge has ruled that federal money can have no role in any aspect of stem cell research. California's billion-dollar Institute for Regenerative Medicine says it'll go ahead anyway. Later on, what comes after the Great Recession? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. President Obama tries to be optimistic, but he concedes that the Great Recession won't go away fast. Others compare it to the Great Depression as just the beginning of a momentous economic change. A bit later, we'll hear some challenging opinions about how American lives are likely to change as well. First, California schools have lost again in the second round of the Obama administration's race to the top in education reform. After the state lost in the first round, Education Secretary Arne Duncan personally encouraged Governor Schwarzenegger to try again. And success would have meant $700 million federal dollars, with $150 million for L.A. Unified and $18 for Long Beach. Jack O'Connell is the state's elected superintendent of public instruction. Always good to have you on our program, although we're sorry about the results.
Well, thank you for having me, Warren, and I share the feeling today of really so many people that work so hard seeking this Race to the Top 2 application. This is the second consecutive that we really worked very hard on. We took a little different philosophy this time, where the Race to the Top 1 8 months ago was really top-down. It was put together from Sacramento, working collaboratively with local school districts. And this time we took a directly opposite, 180-degree opposite approach, changed the paradigm, and we basically asked seven school superintendents to each take charge of the seven areas on the application, and they worked terribly hard. Ray Cortinas and his staff at LAUSD, Chris Steinhauser at Long Beach, and they worked tirelessly really for the last 6 weeks, putting forth a very good application. And again, we just came up a little bit short.
What do you think made the difference?
Hard to say. We're scheduled to get a scorecard back in the next 24 to 48 hours. And so it would really be premature. I could only speculate and, just difficult to predict.
There are those who have pointed out to the fact that Ray Cortinas of LAUSD and Steinhauser of Long Beach both did testify, and that both of them had to say that teachers' unions had not signed the state application. Do you think that made a difference?
It very well could have, and we'll find out for sure probably tomorrow. But I also know that you had 1 year from your notification period in which you could secure the signatures and the support of all of the stakeholder groups. And so is that exclusively why we were not successful? I would think not. But we were able to get more. We had more points this time than we did last time, and not every state can say that. And we keep inching closer. But regrettably, we weren't successful in being able to qualify. We put together a very thoughtful application with I'm most proud of the 302 local education agencies that, to me, really showed vision and courage and leadership and wanted to demonstrate collaboration. We had over 1.7 million children. That's larger than the students in 44 other states, K through 12. And these LEAs serve the student population for the most part that comes from low socioeconomic backgrounds. Better than two out of three students come from low socioeconomic backgrounds in this. So, I'm disappointed, but it's also important to note it's going to slow our reform efforts because of the absence of money, the utilization of data, but it's not going to stop us. We have to continue to be smarter, wiser, and use data that's available to us here today.
Back to the question of the teachers, I understand the superintendents said that within a year of the application, they thought perhaps they could get the unions on board. We talked last night with A.J. Duffy of the United Teachers of Los Angeles, And it didn't really sound that way. He's indicated that he will negotiate, but on this crucial issue of whether test scores can be used to evaluate teachers, particularly with a value-added strategy, he doesn't sound like he's in favor of that at all. How optimistic are you with regard to that, and will that be important, do you think, if there's another application opportunity?
Well, I'm told there will be another race to the top. President Obama announced that he's going to seek about $1.5 billion for a race to the top three. And I think that reasonable minds can come to agreement on this issue of utilizing student data for evaluative purposes, not just of teachers, but also of programs. And that's been sorely lacking in this debate the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I talked about this when I delivered my State of the Education address back in January, how we need to come together, not have something done to someone there or some profession, but really work with. And should a teacher exclusively be evaluated based upon student test scores? To me, the answer is absolutely not. But should it be a part? And I think it should be. And I don't know what the magical number is. In our application, we said 30%. Maybe it's a little more than that. Maybe it's a little less than that. But it should be in consultation with, you know, peer review and review of the principal, maybe even student evaluation or parent evaluation. You know, just a combination. There would be multitude of factors. But I think, you know, with the economic incentive that was there for many of these reforms, I think it would have really helped our schools and improved our reform efforts.
Well, Jack O'Connell, as always, many thanks for being with us. I know you have a meeting of the Board of Education to go to.
Thank you for having me again, Warren. Always nice to be with you.
Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of California. Listening to this, John Dacey, Deputy Superintendent of the L.A. Unified School District, former Superintendent of the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District, coming to be a familiar guest on our program, and good to have you this time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Once again, we just heard Jack O'Connell say that Superintendent Cortinas, your boss, did in fact make the representation that within a year he could get the teachers union on board for the use of the data from student tests to help evaluate teachers. Do you believe that that was a crucial issue, and how's that effort going?
So I think it is a crucial issue, and I think it's been a crucial issue across all of the applications, especially the ones that we know won in the first round, and I think it was considered pretty significantly in the second round. So the answer is, yeah, I think it is very important. How is it going at the moment? You've been certainly tracking the issue very well and have been listening to the program, and we are in the middle of very significant and very good conversations with our labor representatives, and this is both administrative and teachers. And I think what's important is providing an opportunity for people to come to the table to discuss the significance of the issue. I listened very carefully to Mr. Duffy last night, and inside of his comments, and it's not a very easy issue for him to deal with or the union itself, but inside the comments were, we are willing to discuss any proposals. There weren't perfect ones. We know they're not perfect, but it can be better. And I think our goal is to find an opportunity where we can both improve and support the growth of teaching and learning, and hold ourselves accountable by taking a look at all of the measures, but certainly the measure that deals with how students are improving over time.
In the meantime, how much will the loss of $120 or $150 million hurt LAUSD? Sounds like a lot of money, but it's relatively small by comparison to the total budget.
It may be relatively small compared to the total budget, but it was very significant and critical money for this work. So, as you know, there isn't just general fund dollars to help support new initiatives like all of the work that we are rolling out. I mean, the board has convened the Teacher Effectiveness Task Force, and the work that's going to take place around that was very much looking forward to the support of the $153 million. We're going to have to look elsewhere for support, and we're going to have to look elsewhere for the funds simply because I actually believe that the proposal that was written was very thoughtful, lays out a fantastic blueprint, and we're not going to deviate from it.
Well, can you spend the money effectively without the cooperation of the teachers' union?
Good question. Can we spend it effectively? We certainly can't spend it collaboratively, and we believe that the cooperation is essential, and we look forward to working hard to get that cooperation.
What about the kinds of objections that Mr. Duffy made last night and that he's made in the past, that all that's being tested here is English and math, that the educational experience is much more involved than that, and that what happens when so much attention is paid to the evaluations based on the standardized tests, then everybody has to teach to the test?
A couple of points to that. We don't want to be part of an effort which narrows curriculum. That's certainly a very good observation. Second point is that that is true. In order to have the history of test scores for students, because value-add, as you know, is not a test, it's a whole history of growth for students over time, you do need to be able to have a test in a subject area for a longer period of time, and English language arts and math are the ones available in California at the moment. But I said this to you before, and I would say this again. Given our current achievement trends, we have a long way to go before we would be remotely satisfied with the achievement or the growth of achievement in students in those two subjects. No matter how narrow a focus it is, the vast majority of students can do much better. It is our obligation to help them do much better in the fundamental skills of reading to learn, learning to read, learning to compute.
Back again to the question of the tests, third through fifth grade, over a period of 7 years, as I remember.
Yes.
And you look at how each student has done, whether they've improved or whether they have not, then use that information to evaluate the teacher. That's what the value-added system means. The information, according to the LA Times, has been available to the district for a long, long time. You just got there. I take it things are changing.
That is correct. We're building on the opportunities that have been presented to us. The opportunities that the district has constructed over a period of time, there is quite a great deal of energy involved in finding both a reasonable, thoughtful, but collaborative way to move forward on this. You're right. There is a great deal of both data and opportunity to both help improve the critical issue in front of us, which is the active instruction.
How do you think that the district will be involved again if there is, as Jack O'Connell said, there might be a third round of Race to the Top?
I certainly hope so. I personally couldn't imagine that we wouldn't be. And in some ways, Warren, the work that we're engaging in right now around both the Teacher Effectiveness Task Force, finding ways to work collaboratively with all of our unions, which I fully expect we will be successful at doing that, lays the groundwork for, I believe, what will be even a more successful application in the future.
And very quickly, with the state not yet having passed its budget, does that make it more difficult for you to plan for LAUSD in the coming semester?
It makes it incredibly more difficult to plan. There's no question about that. Not only is there the uncertainty, but I would have to say there's the fact that I think it's fairly assured at this point that there's going to be even less resources. So a more difficult situation, and that being not specific, as anybody knows, makes that incredibly difficult. Remember, we didn't tell the youth, especially those joining us for the first time in preschool and kindergarten or students who are entering high school the first time, that there's been an enormous recession. They're expecting the exact same level of service. So to even plan thoughtfully about that without a state budget is an enormous difficulty.
Well, thanks as always for being with us.
Absolutely.
Our next guest is Marty Hittleman. He's president of the California Federation of Teachers. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to our guests separately today because they simply weren't all available at the same time, but we wanted to talk to all of them nonetheless. And Marty Hittleman, it's good to have you on our program. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You did not support California's application for a Race to the Top, nor did the UTLA here in Los Angeles or other unions. We just heard John Dacey of the LAUSD say that such support from teachers is crucial. Do you think your lack of support might have cost California $700 million?
Well, might have. I wouldn't call it lack of support. I would more call it lack of interest by the people at the LA Unified School District and the other districts in really involving the unions in the preparation of the plan. We were really, as I understand it, UTLA was not really asked to be part of the preparation of the plan, that rather they hired people from outside, from the same people that Gates had used in helping other states write their plans, and they decided to go in that direction rather than involving the teachers' union.
So you feel it was a lack of participation then that turned teachers off to this and unions?
Well, I think also the whole Race to the Top competitive approach to funding is not very well received by us. We believe that funding should be based on need, not on who writes the best application. We were also concerned that they were trying to force through unproven changes through the use of money. And now in California, we fell for the bait. We changed some things which I think are foolish, like having 30% of the evaluation of a teacher based on test scores and improvement over time by students when those test scores are really unreliable. So, and there's other things. I think even signing on to the change in the curriculum that they signed on to, where California had among the highest standards in the country, and it would really involve probably lowering standards to go to the core standards. But in order to try to get the money, California agreed, and then they didn't get the money either. But there's other things, too. You know, the scoring has been questioned, the way they scored. I know that I looked at the way they scored the states the first time, and there were five scorers scoring each state's application. And what I saw was that if California had had the top score from each scorer on each question, we would have been third in the country. There was huge variability from the people that were scoring from one to the next. So it might be the same thing, and that might be one of the reasons why California lost. But if you look at Washington, D.C., there's probably no school system that's worse in terms of working with their teachers than Washington, D.C., and they got a grant. So maybe it's not just the fact that the labor union didn't sign on.
Back to the idea of using the test scores, Randy Weingarten, head of the American Federation of Teachers, supports the idea of using them, although she says she wants to keep it at a very low percentage. I don't know what it is, if it's 30 or something below that. Is there division amongst the teachers that are in the labor movement? Or do you think that you're winning or losing?
Well, there's a huge difference. I mean, you know, I'm a mathematician, and I know something about the statistics, and I know that the value-added methodology is just not ready for prime time. There's too much variability. A third of the teachers change from one group, one standing to another. You know, half the teachers in the top 10% are no longer in the top 10% the next year. There's huge variability. Now, we don't, I don't object, and the California Federation of Teachers doesn't object to using these scores for helping the teacher look at what they might change and talking to other teachers about what they're doing. But as far as using it for evaluation, I think it's really ill-conceived.
Well, isn't that sort of apples and oranges? I mean, aren't you asking to have it both ways? If you use it one way or for one thing and find it useful, but reject it for another?
Well, no, because it was never designed to evaluate teachers. That's not, or to, it's also, you don't use a test that has low stakes for the students. The tests that the students take in the school have no influence on their grades or anything else. And then they want to use those results for high-impact reasons to evaluate teachers. It just doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
You want to use the tool for what the tool was designed to do. Now, a lot of information is good. In fact, I think that when you evaluate people, you have to evaluate them. But improvement doesn't come in that process. Because if you're being evaluated, it's very difficult for you to say, I'm doing something wrong. So you have to take that out of evaluation and put it into growth. And I've seen places where that works. In fact, in the LA Unified School District, they have the Peer Assistance and Review Program, which has been going on for some time, although the state keeps defunding it, which is very useful in helping teachers improve. And it's completely separated from evaluation.
Okay. I'm sorry to say that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
And thank you, and you do a good job.
Marty Hittleman, president of the California Federation of Teachers. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Alney back with Which Way LA. The Obama administration has allowed the use of federal money for stem cell research as long as the work does not involve the actual destruction of human embryos to obtain the cells. Yesterday, a federal judge in Washington said such research is not segmented, but a continuing process, and he ruled that the Obama guidelines violate the intent of Congress. California voters approved $3 billion of state money for stem cell research, now controlled by the Institute of Regenerative Medicine. Art Torres is former head of the state Democratic Party. He's now vice chair of the Institute. Welcome, as always, to our program.
Thank you, Warren. It's nice to talk to you on a totally different issue.
Totally different issue. It is good to change the subject. Does the Institute fund projects that also use federal money, and will they therefore be affected by this ruling?
Well, just a few moments ago, Francis Collins, who heads up the National Institute of Health, said that dozens of stem cell experiments will continue despite the judge's ruling, but that any future studies may very well be in jeopardy, and he sees that that would temporarily forbid any additional money from the federal government being applied to grants not only in California but across the country.
So you're governed then by what the National Institutes of Health does?
No, we are not governed by them at all. When the voters voted for Prop 71, they created this agency and put it into the Constitution of California, so it is protected in that respect so that we can continue embryonic stem cell research without federal intrusion. What this decision will have an impact is on those labs that may exist in California that are partially funded by NIH, whether or not they can continue full board, and that's what we're looking at to how we can help in those areas. But the disease teams that we approved that are now close to human clinical trials in Lou Gehrig's disease, stroke, dry macular degeneration, and diabetes and HIV will continue.
So there won't be then the kind of chaos that earlier was predicted by the president of your organization, Alan Trounson.
Well, he was mentioning the chaos that would appear and affect other states in the nation. Not so much of a chaos here in California specifically.
So what about the decision itself? And do you have any indication as to whether the Obama administration will appeal it?
Everything I've heard from the administration indicates to me that the Department of Justice is reviewing it, and I believe that they will move forward with an appeal. This is a very integral part of the president's commitment to find cures for patients across the nation, and stem cell research is very much a part of that. They also feel that this decision went beyond even the Bush prohibition to basically disallow any type of embryonic stem cell research that involves a federal grant. And that's where we think we will prevail, or at least the administration can prevail in the appellate court. And then, of course, I think ultimately this thing will move on to the U.S. Supreme Court.
If it doesn't go this way, ultimately, or your way, I should say, ultimately, and there's no federal money for any stem cell research, what will that mean in California?
Well, that we will have to come up with more grants that will help those labs stay in operation. Right now, we've established a number of stem cell labs at various institutions, which have been a combination of California general obligation bond monies and a lot of philanthropic donors. For example, in Southern California, Mr. Eli Broad, who you and I know very well, has come up to tremendous contributions. The Gross family down at UC Irvine in terms of facilities. So a lot of the combination of these facilities have been absolutely productive for the state in terms of stem cell research. That will continue. What we have to determine is, with the monies that we have available from the sale of these bonds, where will we apply them with increased fervor to those areas that need it?
What about the impact nationwide?
The impact nationwide, as you well know, this is really an international issue. Stem cell research goes across foreign borders, and it's going to have an impact in respect to whatever bilateral partnerships certain states have. Right now, we have California has bilateral partnerships with the states of Maryland, New York, and Wisconsin, and with the countries of the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, Japan, Spain, Germany, and China. Those individual countries provide their own investments and their own monies. We provide ours because we can only spend the money here in California. But the promise that that provides us is an opportunity to engage those scientists from around the world and share information. That's going to have an impact on states like Maryland, Wisconsin, and New York, where they're going to be even more limited than they were before.
The two scientists who ended up as the plaintiffs in this case, which was almost thrown out, as I understand it, said that they have moral objections to using stem cells that are derived from embryos. They do research with adult stem cells, and they say that because of the current practice, they have trouble competing. Do they have an argument?
They really don't. One of the scientists was rejected tenure at MIT and was not allowed to continue and did a 12-day fast. So he has an axe to grind, I think, against science as a whole, especially at MIT. I think what also is occurring here is that there isn't an adverse competition for many of these funds. There obviously is funding for embryonic stem cell research in California, but we also fund adult stem cell, as does the state of Maryland, in respect to research. And the competition has not been adverse. It is based upon the merits of the science. If there is merits in the science that these studies will lead to cures for patients and they're ultimately to clinical trials, then that's really the criteria that is used. So it's, the competition is not for the money. The competition is on the merits.
No cures for diseases have yet occurred as a result of stem cell research. A lot of people say that it's been overhyped and overblown. What do you say to them?
Patience is the key to science, and I'm sure we heard those same comments when we didn't have vaccines for measles and chickenpox or polio. But at the end of the day, we have to have the patience with the science, because ultimately everything that I have seen bodes very clearly that we're going to get there. And we may get there sooner with some diseases as opposed to others, but we're going to get there. And sometimes, surprisingly, much more quickly than even some of us had anticipated, with some of these trials that are ongoing now in California and also those that are potentially there within the next 48 months.
Art Torres, Vice Chair of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, created by Prop 71 to do stem cell research. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. What comes after the Great Recession? Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Forget the argument about the stimulus and the deficit. We're having the wrong conversation. That's according to Richard Florida, who says we need to blow up the fundamentals of our economy. He's a professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and author of the book The Great Reset. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Now, let's start with the Great Reset. What do you mean by that? And is the Great Recession, as we call it, time for one?
Well, when the economic crisis hit, I was able to go back and look at the previous two analogous events. Obviously, the Great Depression of 1929 and the 1930s, and then the Panic and Long Depression of 1873 and thereafter. And what I was able to glean from that was three key things that I think are really important and comments that have been made but need to be inserted into our conversation. One is that these are really long-term processes. The average duration of one of these economic crises or resets is 2 to 3 decades from start to finish. So they're not short-term processes. They're very different than average business cycles. And the way out of them involves two components. The first tends to be relatively well understood by economists and historians, and that involves major new waves of innovation, as occurred in the 1880s and again in the 1930s, with Alexander Field as noted, was the most technologically progressive decade of the 20th century, far outdistancing the 1990s and 2000s. Improvements in productivity and efficiency, and big upgrades in human capital, and massive changes in our educational system. But the third factor is the one that's been missing from the conversation. Not only to improve our productivity and innovation and upgrade our human capital, a big component of what has helped the United States recover from recessions or economic crises and undergird prosperity was dramatic shifts in the way we live and in our geography. The shift from an agrarian nation to an urban industrial nation in the late 19th century, and the shift from just an urban to a suburban nation in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And I think that's been underemphasized. And in order to begin to think about the ways we can reset and recover and enjoy a new round of prosperity, it not only is enough to improve our productivity, stimulate our economy, we're going to have to once again change how and where and the way we live.
Can you be specific? What kinds of changes do you anticipate?
Well, first, by way of historical analogy, I mean, there's a lot of conversation about what got us out of the Depression. Was it New Deal spending? Was it rising working class wages? A new social compact? Was it military mobilization? But the one thing that gets forgotten in that conversation is that what really stimulated the United States economy after the Depression and the war was what I would call simply a form of geographic Keynesianism, a set of public policies which mobilized and encouraged suburban home ownership, which fueled fueled demand for the products coming out of U.S. factories. When you bought a house, you had to fill it up with, you had to buy a car, refrigerator, washer, dryer, appliances, television, and whatnot. Today, in order to fuel our economy again, I think it's not only enough to provide stimulus. In fact, I think we've been propping up our housing market and auto industry far too much, our mortgage finance system. We're going to have to create a new way of life, which makes housing and cars and energy more efficient, less of a dramatic part of a consumer spending bill or household spending. I think it's anywhere from 55% to 75% of household income are spent on those things, and we have to free up space to consume all of the items that are being driven by a more technology or knowledge-driven economy. So we're going to have to shift the way Americans consume, not only increase productivity, if we're going to open up demand and spur the development of new technologies, more development in new industries.
What kind of new technologies do you think are going to be needed?
Well, I think what we've seen over the past 20 or 30 years is the development of a whole series of new leading-edge industries. And on the one hand, those are self-evident: software, information technology, biotechnology, robotics, productivity-improving technologies used in our factories, and a whole range of healthcare and biotech and biomedical technologies. I think the other wave of industries that we talk far less about are industries which are much more experiential and entertainment-driven. So the rise of artistic, culturally creative industries, and then a whole set of industries that are related to more holistic health and personal development, everything from personal coaching to personal training to better food, nutritionism, and all of that sort of thing. So I think the U.S. industrial structure, as far as I can see, looking at this in pretty great detail, has evolved not only away from a manufacturing to a service-based industry, but to a knowledge and creative industry. Now the point that others have talked about, and I think is absolutely apt, is that what's really terrifying about this, abjectly terrifying, is that our economic structure is becoming almost entirely bifurcated. So we're generating, on the one hand, a reasonable number of high-paying, high-skill, knowledge, high human capital, creative jobs, but we're generating an equal or slightly greater number of relatively low-skill and terribly low-paying, insecure, financially unstable jobs in kind of routine services. And one of the points I think that is just exceptionally important to put on the table of our national dialogue, and I've seen this get absolutely no traction in Washington, is that there's only one way out of this. A century ago, or 60 or 70 years ago, we turned manufacturing jobs from bad, low-paying jobs into good jobs. We did that through a variety of techniques. The only way we're going to stop this bifurcation, because we can't educate everyone and upskill everyone into high-paying knowledge jobs, is we're going to have to make an effort to transition a goodly portion of the 60 million service jobs, low-wage, insecure, financially unstable jobs we have. We're going to have to figure out a way to turn them into good jobs. We did it before in manufacturing. We're going to have to try to do it again now with services.
Very quickly, if you can, how did we do it before with manufacturing jobs, blue-collar jobs that were dirty and difficult and dangerous?
Well, remember Henry Ford saying that in order to sell cars, he had to pay his workers a $5 day. If he didn't pay his workers a $5 day, nobody could afford a car. So what happened was, of course, there was a whole series of groundswell efforts on part of workers to organize themselves into unions. Federal policy like the Wagner Act, which gave workers the right to organize and bargain collectively. And then I think a massive effort during the Depression and during the war to figure out a new social compact with hinged wages, at least for a good percentage of our manufacturing workers, the productivity improvements. But most importantly, we were able to channel improvements in productivity, innovations in the factory floor, into higher wages for workers. When it comes to service work today, I think that's the key element. We're going to have to begin to see service workers in low-end routine jobs much more like we see manufacturing workers on our factory floors. And I think one of the great successes that we forget in America is that we revolutionized our factories under the pressure of Japanese and German competition in the 1980s and 1990s. And our factories, the ones that remain, are humming along and are hyper-efficient and are in many ways models for the world and leading-edge manufacturers. I think the last great frontier of inefficiency in the U.S. economy is in this terribly underutilized and inefficient service sector. And in order to improve our economy and to improve wages in that sector, we're going to have to see workers as an asset, engage them in continuous improvement, engage them and attach them and engage them in their work, and see them as a source of productivity and innovation. And that's the only way I can think that we can begin to move forward and improve wages in that sector.
Richard Florida, author of the book Reset, and a professor of management at the University of Toronto. David Leonard is economics columnist at the New York Times. He's a staff writer for the paper and for the New York Times Magazine. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Professor Florida says he sees no evidence in Washington that there's any movement at all in the direction he thinks we need to go. What do you think, first about the direction, and secondly about whether it's on the radar screen in Washington?
I'm happy to be cynical about Washington, and we may get a chance to get into that. I do, though, think that parts of this are on the radar screen. I think that one of the reasons that the United States economy accomplished this incredible productivity revolution in blue-collar jobs was that we were the first country in the world that made a high school education something that was for the masses. When we were beginning to do this in the early 20th century, there were countries in Europe that looked at us and said, that's a waste. A high school education is wasted on the common person, and they're not going to be able to use it. And we went to this universal high school model, and it paid enormous dividends. And some of those dividends it paid were in the blue-collar jobs. Larry Katz and Claudia Golden have written a book about this called The Race Between Education and Technology. And one of the things that they discovered as they dug into fairly fine-grained data, as well as the big stuff, was that you see in places that moved ahead in education, you see their companies getting more productive. And that really shouldn't be any kind of mystery, right? I mean, education, when it's done well, is about learning how to do new things and learning how to do existing things better. And so when you had more educated workers, what that meant is that not only the clerical jobs, but also the blue-collar jobs, the people in those jobs were able to be more productive. And so you built these great companies, the Caterpillars, the GMs, you name it. And so I actually do think that in terms of the long-term issues, Washington has made an enormous amount of progress on education in the last year. We can't be guaranteed yet that it's going to work. And in fairness, a lot of the progress has been states responding to the Race to the Top program. But we've really seen huge, huge changes in education on the federal and the local level. And there are reasons to hope, at least, that they are going to pay some kinds of long-term dividends. Now, it is true that they won't pay short-term dividends. They will not put back to work the 15 million people who are now unemployed. And that's where Washington is really paralyzed. It hasn't figured out how to take further steps to help the economy in the short term, even though on some of the long-term stuff, I actually think it's been one of the success stories of recent months.
David Leonard of the New York Times. Richard Florida, back to you. Is progress, even if there is progress on education, enough to make the kinds of changes that you're looking for?
Well, I first of all, I want to echo David's comments and also the importance of the Goldens and Katz work, which when Alexander Field looked at that work again, he looked at a combination of the improvements in education in tandem with improvements in productivity and innovation as they work together. Both worked hand in hand, improvements in human capital and education, a round of innovation to power prosperity. But here's what I was able to uncover looking back at these two previous resets, again, the 1870s and 80s, the 1930s and 40s. The changes we made in education were massive. During the first Great Reset, we basically invented mass public education. Now, that was typically grade school education, grades 1, 2, 3, 4, to provide basic literacy and fluency in the three R's and to tool up our immigrants for the work in those earliest factories. My dad, who was born in 1921, was a product of that. He got a seventh grade education, but he had to quit school at age 13 to take up work in a factory. During the Depression, for those kids who were a little bit younger than my dad, we made a massive improvement in high school education, as David aptly points out, and Golden and Katz go into. We also, after the war, massively expanded with the GI Bill our college and university education. My dad tells a story of being an infantry soldier in the medical school, he would tell me, and they said, you know, we want to send you back to school to become a medical doctor, assuming he had a high school education, because he proved facile at that. And he said, I can't go back to school. I only have a seventh grade education. Well, he made him an education parent for myself and my brother. But the point is, the retooling of education we need now for a knowledge-driven and a creative economy makes what happened in the first reset, the emergence of a new schooling, public schooling system, and the second reset, the expansion of high school education and the GI Bill, look small by comparison The effort we need for human capital upgrading far exceeds anything most people, aside from perhaps Bill Gates and others at the frontier of this debate. We need to completely remake our educational system, and it can be remade in ways that focus on individualized learning, lifelong learning. We know that our school system is a giant creativity squelching machine. So the point I'm trying to make is if we're going to reimagine this system, it has to be done at a far grander scale than I currently hear the debate being articulated in Washington.
Robert Poland is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He studies the economics of building a clean energy economy in the United States. And Professor Poland, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Let me go back to the very beginning when we heard the phrase geographic Keynesianism. What about consumer spending in all of this? And what about the millions that are unemployed now? If what we're hearing is more about the long-term, what about the short-term?
Well, any kind of Keynesianism right now, in my view, is superior to kind of the ascendant austerity arguments that are being made. President Obama introduced this commission on the fiscal deficit. It's supposed to deliver its results in December, but the two co-chairs of the commission have already said that the fiscal deficit is a cancer on the economy and needs to be closed. So by Keynesianism we mean direct aggressive measures to promote job creation in the short term, I am strongly in favor of that. And I don't see those, by the way, as being in any way inconsistent with what Professor Florida was talking about. I will say one thing quickly, though. The one thing he left off, which I think is probably, in my view, that the central transformation that needs to take place over the next generation is building a clean, green economy. And that, in my view, also has very strong positive short-term elements in terms of job creation and investing in innovation, as well as the long-term output of fighting global climate change.
Robert Poland is professor of economics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. When we began this program, we talked about with Richard Florida, who believes that it is old news and old-time thinking to worry about the deficit. And yet, Robert Poland, you say that's exactly what's happening with the Obama Commission. What's wrong with it, in your opinion?
What's wrong with it, Warren, in my view, is that we are far from having achieved a sustainable economic recovery. And as such, all of the forces that we have in play, economic policy tools, need to be concentrated on building and sustaining a recovery. And the more we think instead about setting deficit reduction as our priority on cutting, we are going to face the possibility of a double-dip recession, as they are experiencing now in Great Britain and Greece, precisely because they placed austerity and budget cutting ahead of a recovery.
So what should we be spending the money on?
Well, deficit is a problem. I don't want to say the deficit is not a problem. And as I see it, the primary short-term issue is not the deficit per se, but that the credit markets are locked up. The banks are sitting on $1 trillion of cash reserves, whereas 3 years ago they held about $20 billion in cash reserves. So that we need policies to move credit back into the private sector. So it doesn't. I'm not thinking about a strictly government spending led recovery. We need government spending to continue to sustain state and local governments, as I think your other guest, Mr. Zandi, has made the point often. Promoting state and local spending is one of the strongest multipliers, job creators, that we can introduce now, and we have to sustain that. But we also then have to get the private sector to lend, invest, and create jobs.
Mark Zandi now has been introduced twice and yet not heard from, a chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Always good to have you on our program.
You.
Thanks a lot for being here. So how do you get the banks to loosen up? And is that, in the short term, the most important thing of all?
To get the banks to loosen up on credit.
Yeah.
The availability of credit. Well, I think that's just going to take a bit of time. I think the large banks, the big bank holding companies, are now very well capitalized, and they can lend, but they're very reluctant to, and will remain so until unemployment has definitively peaked and house prices have clearly started to rise. And and we're not there yet. So we've got a bit of a chicken and egg kind of problem in the banking system, and I think it's just going to take time for them to get their groove back, get the confidence necessary to go out and start to extend credit. Now, there is a bit of good news on that front. I do think it's fair to say that the credit spigot, which has been very tightly closed for quite some time, is starting to open a little bit. So we are starting to see some credit flow a little bit more freely, but I think it's just going to take time before banks feel more comfortable to and get out there lending more aggressively.
You said chicken and egg. There's a catch-22 here, isn't there? If the banks are reluctant to lend, isn't the lending what's going to start the economy going and create the jobs?
Yeah, you said it just very, very nicely, and there's a lot of kind of chicken-egg problems in our economy right now. But I think that goes to a broader point, and that is the economy is in recovery. Things have improved measurably from where they were a year ago, but they're not improving as fast as anyone would like, and I don't think they will. I think this is going to be a bit of a slog. We're not going to come roaring out of the gates. It's just going to take time for us to really get going here.
Richard Florida said earlier that what he calls these resets sometimes take 2 or 3 decades. Are you essentially saying the same thing?
No, I don't think it's take 2 or 3 decades. I think it'll take another year, 2 or 3, before we're off and running. But I do think it'll take a lot longer than that to recover all of the jobs, the 8.4 million jobs that we lost in the recession, and it'll take a lot longer than that to get unemployment back down to where we consider it to be full employment. So I don't think it's decades. I think it's years, but years in the context of 9.5% unemployment is pretty uncomfortable.
Do you agree that the new jobs are going to have to look very different from the old jobs? Is it going to be necessary, for example, to take people in the service economy and effectively create a new middle class?
Yeah, it will look different, but I think what the jobs will look like is coming into view. I think we are focused, and the administration and policymakers are focused on the right thing, and that is trying to sell what we produce to fast-growing countries overseas, emerging economies where there are young populations and emerging classes, and the people there desperately want to raise their standard of living, and they're going to consume lots of different things, and we're going to produce the things that they want to consume. And I'm much more optimistic in this regard, I think if you're a U.S. manufacturer or a U.S. service company that survived what we just went through, you've got to be doing something right. You have to be very, very productive. You have to have a market niche. And I think as these emerging economies grow and develop, we will be able to successfully sell into them. And it'll be we'll be selling things that we all understand and know, things, aircraft and machine tools and computer equipment, sophisticated materials. But it also will be services. We're really good at producing accounting, legal services, engineering, architectural design, management consulting. I'm an economist, and most of my work now is selling into Asia, South America, and in parts of Europe. Even financial services, may I dare say. So I do think we are well positioned. It's not going to happen next month or even within a year, but I think over the course of the next several years, we will be selling more overseas, and that's where the growth and where the jobs are going to come from.
Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Back to Professor Poland at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. You're focused on the clean energy economy. That's quite different from exports.
Well, there is a huge component of international trade connected to the clean energy economy, Warren. In fact, this is one of the issues that the development of manufacturing capacity and building wind energy, solar energy, and so forth, it's well known that other countries, Germany, Spain, China, Japan, Korea, are way ahead of us, and that we are importing even some of the things that are part of the stimulus program in terms of manufacturing components are being imported because we don't produce them. So one of the things, if we want to talk about kind of the, merging the long-term vision with the short-term needs, is to get the industrial policy right that will promote manufacturing development in clean energy, which I think picks up strongly on the theme that Professor Florida was talking about. I mean, what could be more creative over the long term than the transformation of our fundamental economic base from fossil fuel driven economy to a clean energy economy, and let's build the manufacturing capacity here. There's a generation of work to be done to achieve that, and it can't be done strictly on the basis of the free market. Just as all the major technical innovations of the last century, the jet engine, aviation, computers, internet, were all subsidized primarily by the Defense Department, and then they were delivered to the market. And that's the kind of industrial policy that I think that we need that would advance new creative activities, new jobs throughout the economy.
Let me go back to David Leonard, the economics columnist at the New York Times and staff writer at the New York Times magazine. You said, pardon me, you said earlier that you'd be willing to discuss your cynicism about what's going on in Washington. Let me give you a chance to do it.
Well, it does have to do with these short-term issues. I am worried about the deficit over the long term. I think we've made a whole bunch of promises on, mainly on health care and Medicare, that we can't afford to keep. People are expecting larger benefits than they've paid in taxes for those benefits. And we've got the baby boom coming, which exacerbates the problem. So I think it's absolutely right for us to be thinking about the long-term deficit. I think it's serious. I think solving it needs to involve cuts to Medicare, cuts to Social Security, cuts to military. It needs to involve higher taxes. It needs to involve all sorts of things that voters basically at this point are against. But that doesn't change the fact that the economy still is too weak in the short term, and spending money in the short term to try to improve it doesn't materially affect our long-term deficit. That is just a much different problem in terms of size and timing. And so the idea that the Senate and the House, well, that's actually not fair to the House. The idea that the Senate has been frozen and hasn't really done anything to encourage more economic activity, I think is really disappointing. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. I think one is that for reasonable strategic reasons, the Republicans have decided not to cooperate. I think another is that some of the Democrats, the swing Democrats, are from states like Nebraska and other parts of the middle of the country that are actually quite healthy right now relative to the rest of the country, and so they are not as worried about the condition of the economy. And I think it's hard sometimes to see the effect, but today's news on housing numbers are actually yet another reminder of how the stimulus program did make a big difference. The reason we've seen this huge plunge in home sales in July is that the tax credit for home sales expired. And so it's a reminder that when the government wants to give people incentives to spend money, whether it's companies or consumers, it can make a difference. And the big stimulus bill wasn't big enough to get the economy healthy again, and it's running out now. And Congress has done little things, but Mark Zandi's talked about this a lot. There really is no form of stimulus that's more effective than aid to states, and Congress hasn't done enough of that.
Okay, we've ranged over a lot of different topics. Thank you all so much. David Leonard with the New York Times, Richard Florida, The Great Reset at the University of Toronto, Robert Polin at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and Mark Zandi, Chief Economist of Moody's Analytics. Good to have all of you on our program. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point, Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Christian Bordahl, Karen Radziner, and Sonia Geis, our technical director, Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla, and check us out on Facebook. I'm Marvin Alney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.